This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILAM 580, The Information Advantage. I'm Bill Hammack, substituting for Celeste Quinn. Now, usually you only hear me for a few minutes on Tuesday mornings talking about engineering and life, but today I take a deeper look at one aspect of technology, television. My guest is the television critic for the New York Daily News and is best known to most listeners here as a regular commentator on NPR's Fresh Air. Today we're going to discuss all aspects of television, especially looking at the rise of new types of shows, and our guest will work with me to make us what he calls teleliterate. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or anywhere else you can call me at 800-222-WILL, that's 333-9455, and 800-222-9455. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, David Bianculli.
Well, hi there. Welcome right back to you.
David, you wrote a book in the mid-1990s called A Dictionary of Teleliteracy. And what did you mean by teleliteracy?
That was just supposed to be the idea that whether we wanted to admit it or not, that part of being fluent in our culture meant being fluid in television, that there were things that all of us carried around, whether it was something really vital like watching a moonshot or watching JFK get shot, or something that is just sort of an icon of entertainment like a Columbo or a JR or an Archie Bunker.
So, go ahead.
So I was just collecting those things into one and then admitting that even the stuff that shouldn't be in there somehow managed to permeate and stick, like Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island.
So when you said memorable, you didn't necessarily mean good.
Right. I've had lots of memorable meals that resulted in food poisoning.
And at the time, I think this book was written in the mid-1990s, and I think the current edition is 96, is
yes.
That right? And there was a bunch of books like The Dictionary of Cultural Literacy.
Yeah, that was actually, the publisher's idea was that was a real knee slapper,
mm-hmm.
to play off the Dictionary of Cultural Literacy and call it the Dictionary of Teleliteracy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with a title like that, sales just did zoom.
Well, it is still in print. I noticed you can still get it at Amazon.
It's gone through a couple of different publishers that all seem eager to do it in paperback. And actually, we're planning a larger, retitled, redesigned, updated trade edition that'll be coming out in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, I'm working on these books take a long time to write when you have like 9 full-time jobs. Trust
mm-hmm.
me.
Sure. Do you have a title for that new book?
The new book is the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and the subtitle, if I can remember it, is The Laughter, The Lawsuit, The Legacy. not quite as catchy as the Dictionary of Teleliteracy, but...
No. Well, David, I want to talk to you about some of the new genres of shows that are emerging, and I want to start with one of my favorite shows of the last couple of years. I am not ashamed to admit that I've watched every single American Idol and that I've even voted every time.
Okay.
And so I want to know from you, what is it that made American Idol really compelling television viewing? And you might explain the premise of the show for those.
Well, the first thing I want to ask you back before I get into that is
yes.
I want to know there's a dividing line. I have no problem with you really liking American Idol.
Yes.
We will get into what makes that appealing. But I have to know whether you also got into American Junior.
No, I did not.
Good.
I did not find it interesting. I found that slightly cruel.
Yes.
Where these were adults that were making a decision and trying to do something.
Exactly. It was really creepy to me to take it to the under 21 set. Like,
I think creepy is an excellent word for it, even better than cruel. So,
but there is something to American Idols which ties into not only the American Dream. It surprises me because I think there are plenty of other talented people in America that didn't make the cut on these shows and didn't make it through the auditions.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe that the people who win are absolutely the most talented people in America or even worthy of that sort of attention.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a fascinating process, both in the early rounds when it's mostly weeding out, and then when you watch about a dozen young people get crash courses in not only public speaking, but public singing and public choreography and just being put under that sort of a pressure.
So there was a sense in watching them improve as performers is a fascinating process.
Yeah, it's like watching someone take a master class is what I think I'm really taking out of it, is that you can watch, if you watch an average American Idol run, and you go back and you see somebody in their audition tapes, and then you see them like 2 or 3 weeks, if they're still there before the finale, they're different people.
Mm-hmm. So was it the judges that made this interesting, just the talent? What are the components of the show?
Well, the judges are a component, but only Simon Cowell, as the judge, really says anything of substance.
So for the listeners who may not have seen it, Simon Cowell was the judge who was rather sardonic and perhaps honest in his own view.
Yes, and imported from the British version, where they quickly learned that over there, supposedly, if television and even just regular daily comportment is more reserved, the idea of someone telling an unvarnished truth is addictive in an odd way. But even in television, with all these talk shows, so much of the discourse you get on television is people being smarmy and polite, and you know, various levels of just pleased with themselves and pleased with everyone around them, that to be able to see negativity when it's in a constructive form or at least a critical form. I mean, he's not just saying mean things to be mean. He's saying mean things when people are out there performing and they're no good. As a critic, I sort of, I get that.
So you found this show compelling, is that true?
Yes.
And could you make us maybe a little more teleliterate about it? I mean, what's the root of this? Is it just Star Search redone, or is there deeper roots in our kind of entertainment culture that this draws on?
Well, Star Search, I mean, it goes even deeper. I mean, you go all the way back to the radio and the Major Bowles Amateur Hour, and then Ted Mack on television. And there is always going to be something really appealing about giving people who don't normally get a chance to be on television, a chance to be on television, and then to be rewarded with stardom is just a big boon. There will always be that draw. I don't quite get it the way everybody wants to be on television.
But it's kind of an American dream or American fantasy, isn't it, to become
famous?
Yeah,
it's more of a nightmare to me, but boy, people seem to really want to be on TV. They don't seem, you know, even in news events after disasters, you never see, maybe they don't ever air them. But, you know, the idea that you can say, no, I don't want to talk to you about TV. And I don't want to be on TV. Go away.
Did you see elements in this from things like The Gong Show? I recall that as a kid with judges. Did you see elements of that in there?
Well, the judges on The Gong Show was, of course, not to be taken seriously, and this sort of is. I'm down in my studio working, so you're going to get phones in the background. Just pretend it's Lou Grant or something.
That's fine.
But there is always going to be an element of the judging and the judged, but you can either do it as a total joke or you can take it somewhat seriously. I think American Idol, in the end, does take it seriously, although the other judges go out of their way to be as nice and supportive as they can.
Even Sacrin.
Which has its place, but, you know, it wouldn't be as watchable if not for Simon.
David, I have a caller that I would like to get to. The caller is from Colorado on line 4.
Okay.
Caller, go ahead.
Yeah, how are you? How are you? I'm particularly interested in sciences and real programming on television. And,
good for you.
And so I'm wondering what you would recommend for being able to get real programming. For example, right now we're facing a real crisis with global warming. The biggest storm in the history of the world is hitting out in the East Coast, And essentially, no talk show is talking about the enormous hazard to the world of global warming.
So, if I can interrupt here, David, our caller has asked a very interesting question, which is when we're looking for more serious fare, maybe beyond American Idol, beyond a sitcom, what is it that you see on the television dial?
Well, there's two questions there, actually. One is, where can you go for the science programming that's worthwhile? And for that, you have to go almost completely to either one of the cable networks or to PBS, where you can get NOVA and Scientific American Frontiers and reliably worthwhile programs like that. The other question that I hear is, how come talk shows don't really talk about things that mean anything?
Well, what do we mean by a talk show, first of all?
Well, there's no reason, really, when you think about it, why Jay Leno and David Letterman couldn't be talking about global warming. Jack Parr talked about issues of the day. it's whether or not the hosts choose to do it, and whether the problem is that television has gotten to be such a competitive environment that if you have even a six-minute segment where you're talking to someone, you know, about science, most of the time they're afraid of how many millions of viewers or hundreds of thousands of viewers will be clicking during that segment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's worthwhile. For example, with the probes that we have now, you know, imminently closing in on Mars and stuff,
mm-hmm.
why not get some of the scientists and some of the NASA people on as guests on those talk shows? I really do think that they would make strong segments.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of this is being displaced by the reality TV shows that are on. And in fact, I wanted to look at that phenomenon with you a little bit. We talked about American Idol, although a difference between that and other reality shows is there. I think the other ones are a little more mean-spirited.
Well, there's so many different types of programming that are falling under the reality TV. Well, it's actually just unscripted.
What differences and distinctions do you make, then, in those reality shows? Do you have a way to think about these?
Well, there are contest-based reality shows. There are elimination reality shows. You know, the contest-based ones are ones where you have to have some talent, and the elimination ones are where you just have to outlast everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are ones that are actually nothing more than thinly veiled documentaries where they just follow people around. And then there are just pure vanity productions that are video diaries.
Do you enjoy these?
Everyone, there are polls mm-hmm. in both of them. I'm surprised. And sometimes I can even start off liking a reality show. And then two or three episodes in, I hate it.
Can you think of one that happened on?
Or? Cupid.
Cupid, okay.
Cupid. It came from Simon Cowell, and the mm-hmm. first episode, I thought, showed an awful lot of promise and was structured very nice, and it was compelling. And by episode two or three, they changed the format on it, and then it was into the choosing and the judging, and it was like very derivative.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that these have taken over? Are these particularly cheap to make?
Yes.
Can you give us, a factor of 10?
Well, in terms of comparing them to an mm-hmm. hour-long drama,
mm-hmm.
they're anywhere from one-quarter to one-tenth the cost.
So
the networks really love them. It's the same reason why news magazines a few years ago proliferated, because they were half the cost or a third of the cost of regular dramatic hours. And if you get the same rating, then it's a big bonus. And you get something like Joe Millionaire
mm-hmm.
that goes through the roof, and all of a sudden you understand, unfortunately, the economic reason why everybody wants to throw something against the wall and see what sticks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess if they're costing a tenth, you can even get much less of an audience and still make a profit. I mean, a thing like Big Brother that I just simply don't hear people talking about has persisted through four versions. So they can also live with lower ratings and still make a profit. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. Another consideration is that they're going after the younger demographic,
mm-hmm.
and that seems reality shows that I can't stand, like Fear Factor, are very popular with young viewers, so they stay on for those reasons. But sometimes advertisers now are balking at buying into these because they don't want to be associated with the worst of them.
Mm-hmm.
And thank goodness we got to the bottom of the barrel pretty quickly. And so now things are going to start to level off.
Well, yeah, let me ask you to be a prophet. I mean, is this something that's going to last, or is it going to be like the 1970s when we were filled with cop shows on television?
It's exactly like the 70s with cop shows and with variety shows and like the mm-hmm. late 50s, early 60s with westerns.
Mm-hmm.
So you think... The networks have learned nothing about how to manage corporate greed, either their own or collectively. Mm-hmm. And so even an individual network like ABC, when it had Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, will throw it on until even the most fervent fan is sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, every other network is doing, how to be a 10,000-aire, how to be a 100,000, mm-hmm. just anything that they can to get close. And so it just, they're all like restaurant owners that are trying to make you not want to come in and look at the menu.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned variety shows. What was the last variety show to really be in the top 10?
I know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
Sonny and Cher.
That was the 1970s.
Yeah, it was. It's more than 25 years ago.
So what happened with the Variety Hour?
One of the big things that happened is that since the last Variety Top 10, cable kicked in the late 70s, early 80s. And so instead of having three major networks where you could sit for Ed Sullivan and the variety itself is appealing, you have a couple of hundred networks where if you're interested, you know, in one form of music or one form of acting or one form of, we don't have a juggling channel yet, mm-hmm. but there's enough niche programming out there that it's harder to get people to sit still for anything they aren't interested in.
So in other words, they can get the variety from just clicking the dial.
Right.
So what did you...
But I still love the variety show, and I want it to come back, and I think that with the right host, it could still be big.
Well, you appreciated American Idol. Was that partly because it was a little like a variety show?
There are elements of it that are very variety show-based. There's something to be said for the live entertainment value. It works on Saturday Night Live as well. And, you know, that's from the infancy of network television.
Well, you mentioned the right host. What about Wayne Brady and his variety show? What happened with that?
He wasn't quite the right host. He's a talented guy, but I think you need someone so dynamic, so familiar, so accepted all the way across the board, somebody like a Carol Burnett, that everyone will dive in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very attuned to this because I'm working on the book on the Smothers Brothers, and I look back at that show now as like a golden show in a golden era.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we'll ever get to that again.
Were you surprised that that the Carol Burnett Reunion Hour, which I think was broadcast last year, the year before, was something like the highest rated show of the season? Some incredible statistic.
Oh, sure, I was surprised. I would be a liar because there had been like three or four Carol Burnett shows before that.
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't scored that highly. There was something about that one. It was outtakes. It was a collection of one of the things that I think everyone who watched Carol Burnett really loved, which was, you know, how Harvey Korman would continually be broken up by Tim Conway, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That special was like an outtakes and goof-ups special.
Well, perhaps they're reaching just the baby boomers and are now in the mood to watch these kind of things.
That's what I thought, and then I, you know, you did the research on the ratings, and there were a lot of young people watching that particular hour. So I don't know,
but I'm surprised.
It certainly got a year of course, because the networks again, greed is good, you know, to quote Wall Street and Gordon Gekko. But so they all went after nostalgia until we were sick of all these Laverne and Shirley reunion shows.
David, you mentioned cable, and I want to talk about the cable channels for a bit. Specifically, a phenomenon where they're showing these very gritty shows, and I'm thinking of 6 Feet Under, Sopranos, Sex and the City, and I believe FX has a show called Risk about gambling, if I have the name right.
Oh, no, that was Lucky.
Lucky.
It's already been canceled.
Oh, it has.
Yeah.
But is there something that the networks are missing that the cable is picking up here? When you watch one of these, you know for sure you're not watching a network show. So why have these come about, and is there ones of them that you like in particular?
Well, they've come about as a form of counter-programming, but I haven't given up on the networks being able to do quality drama network television. I think...
You said you've given up on them?
No, I haven't.
You haven't, okay.
I mean, The West Wing, when it's at its best, NYPD Blue, when it's at its best, those are really good programs, and I really... Right now, in the last couple of years, I've been very enthusiastic about Alias and 24, which are kind of high-concept spy shows, but they're really well done.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy them, you know, even more than I enjoyed I Spy when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. They remind me of Mission Impossible in some ways, which was one of my favorites.
Right, but when you talk about the stuff that cable is doing so well right now, it is being braver about showing compromised, complex characters and situations. Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm is such an irascible old coot, but it's a great character. I think of, imported by PBS, the British series Fawlty Towers, and you had John Cleese doing Basil Fawlty, and he was just, you shouldn't like this guy, but you did, and he got in these situations that just pained you because they were so bad. Now, that's the same formula as I Love Lucy, but, you know, when you do it to a character that's technically unlovable and you love them anyway, it's just really good performing and really good writing.
But why did this fail with a show like Buffalo Bill with Dabney Coleman?
It's a perfect thing to point to. I don't know why. I think that NBC at that time didn't have a lot of patience with it, that the ratings for Buffalo Bill were not that bad. It's just that they weren't as good as the shows around it.
So you think they could have waited and developed that?
I think so. I think with time, that was such a great show with a great cast. But television gets nervous about unlikable characters or complicated characters.
So of these shows with complicated characters, which is as good a way to describe them as anything, are there ones on HBO and FX and others that you are watching that you enjoy?
Oh, sure. The newest batch I'm not really sold on, the Carnival and then mm-hmm. the reality series. Well, it's not quite a reality. I don't know what that is, K Street, Tanner 88. But
right.
But neither one of those really grabbed me. But I love The Sopranos. I really like 6 Feet Under and Sex and the City, which I did not like when they premiered. It took about one season of Sex and the City and a half a season of 6 Feet Under
mm-hmm.
Before I thought they really got to the point where they knew what they were doing, or at least I liked what they were doing.
I think that's fair. 6 Feet Under is one that my wife and I enjoy a great deal, and oddly enough, we actually watch the opening sequence and enjoy that every time.
Yeah. Well, opening sequences, this is one of the things that television just doesn't do well enough anymore.
Mm-hmm.
St. Elsewhere was my favorite show in the 80s, and mm-hmm. I remember every week when that theme started, it just made me feel good, and I watched those opening credits so intently just because I knew I was guaranteed a good hour and just because it was just so nice. Yeah, the 6 Feet Under credits are really beautifully visually dense and clever.
Mm-hmm.
So are the opening credits for Carnival, by the way, but mm-hmm. the show doesn't live up to them yet.
And that's on HBO also, is
yes.
that right? Uh-huh. Well, we're talking here a little bit about cable and cable programming. The other alternative to network, of course, is public broadcasting, and we had a listener call in to ask about more serious programming.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that's going on with PBS? The headlines seem to indicate a ratings decline and revenues are very tight. What are the bright spots at PBS?
I don't know what the bright spots are at PBS. The bright spots are that they haven't abandoned the big giant glaciers that they should be proud of, the Ken Burns, the Rick Burns.
Mm-hmm.
The big one this later on this month is a program called The Blues, which is helmed by Martin Scorsese and is a seven different filmmakers. These big things, I think public television still does well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, in part PBS is a victim of its own success. There are entire networks now on cable devoted to some of the programs that PBS used to show.
Well, that's an interesting thing to say, yet when I watch, say, Discover, and maybe that's not what you were talking about, but when I watch Discover, I can tell for sure that's not PBS. Are you saying that's things like the BBC channel and others?
Some of the stuff that went on BBC, some of the stuff on National Geographic channel, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hell, I'm so old that I even remember when tennis was only shown on on public television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there are certain things that it did, and it popularized, and then they got so popular that it couldn't do it anymore. But some of the things that PBS did best in the 80s that it abandoned because some of its member stations didn't like them as much, I think was a major mistake. There was about almost an entire decade there where American Playhouse was offering some of the best television on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of ended. We still have American Masters, which is quite good. We still have American Experience. But American Playhouse, it should never have stopped.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with David Bianculli, who's television critic for the New York Daily News and for NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And we're talking, of course, about television. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL, if you're in the area, or anywhere else. Call at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. So, David, to return to PBS a little bit, the story there is that other channels and cable and such arose and really took some of their mission away from them. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, I don't think that PBS knows what it wants to be now. It doesn't know how to fundraise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it knows how to fundraise. It knows how to get the money it's still getting, but it hasn't figured out an alternative way, and the way that it has irritates a lot of the people that are still supporting it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I sort of feel like public television is like a parent, you know, and, you know, the viewers, the members are the parents that are farming out money to this child that, you know, come on, straighten up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not straightening up.
So what would you like to see PBS become if you could give them a mission?
I wouldn't mind. Well, first of all, we sort of lost the base early on. I mean, the British model way back in the early days of the BBC is that you do it almost as a taxed base where everybody has to give a little bit of a share to support this. That would have been the way to go. But failing that, I don't like the fact that most pledge breaks and pledge months are built around programs that have very little to do with what PBS offers the rest of the time.
Now, that's a very odd thing to do, because when we're looking at public radio, which I know quite well, we fundraise during the programs and the actual programs you hear. Why is it that PBS shows these specials?
They have their little research guys. They say that they can raise more money doing self-help things and doo-wop specials and all of these things that they do, and that the regular people they count on to pledge anyway, and they need the extra people that are sort of drawn to those. But I think that's a little disloyal and a little awful.
Disingenuous, maybe.
Worse than disingenuous. Mm-hmm. I think they should be ashamed of themselves.
Okay, that is worse. So, is there no bright spots for public broadcasting that you want to share with us? Is there...
No. The president right now, Pat Mitchell, she's talks about some of these problems and she's aware of them, and she's sensitive to them. So that's better than having someone insensitive up there.
Mm-hmm.
But if every year we meet with the executives of PBS and they still say they're working on the same problems, they're not working on them very well.
Well, maybe let's turn our attention then to television news a bit. That has been a huge phenomenon, actually, the rise of cable news network and the Fox Channel and CNBC, MSNBC. First of all, when we're looking at a typical show on these, what is the typical audience for those hourly? Do you have a feel for that?
Oh, yeah, dinky.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of thousands. I mean, it amazes me when, as a member of the media, I watch how much attention is being paid to programs that get so few viewers.
So look, can we give a range of numbers here? Is it about 100,000?
Oh, well, you know, 240,000 or something would be a regular midday audience for MSNBC.
So,
and this is nationwide, and it bounces, it fluctuates. But the point of the real thing is that newspapers and the news side, not even necessarily the television critics, but in their newsrooms, they have TVs in there, and they have them tuned to CNN and maybe MSNBC and Fox News, and so they're a constant presence in the newsroom. And so news is driven a little bit more by them when they're not really a presence in, you know, most people's homes. Even the most popular primetime news channel, which is Fox News, you know, is about the only one that's capping more than 1 million viewers right now.
So to put this maybe in a little bit of context, I think that the NBC Today show has 3 to 4 million listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Or viewers, I should say.
Yeah.
And Seinfeld was looking at 15, 16 million listeners. So they're talking audiences that are a tenth of Seinfeld when we're talking about...
And Seinfeld's an extreme example, but I mean, even a regular sitcom like According to Jim on ABC with Jim Belushi gets 2 or 3 times the audience easy of any of these programs that we've been discussing.
And According to Jim is something of a disappointment to its network. Is that a fair statement?
No, not to ABC.
Not to ABC. Okay.
ABC is sort of a disappointment to itself.
Yes.
So it's very happy with According to Jim simply because it's a competitive half hour.
Right. I think their highest rated was 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Daughter or something.
Yes, and John Ritter just died, so, you know... I think that would be the end of the show on any other network, but it's ABC.
Right there. David, I have a caller on line 4. Line 4, please go ahead.
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Okay, I'd like to ask a very simple question. Why is television so bad? I have so many friends who are absolutely getting rid of cable, getting rid of television, won't let their children look at it. It's just a degradation of America. It's going down and down and down. Look at Comedy Hour, you know, Comedy Channel. It's as foul as it can be, and that foulness is it's going over to other programs.
You said foul?
It's not dealing in wit and good humor. It's not dealing in cleverness. If it's not TNA, it doesn't shake.
David, would you care to defend South Park? What?
Well, it is very funny. I mean, there, you can divide it into programs that are trying to push the envelope merely to survive, and programs that have something to say and are using a rawer way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
There are both types of TV. I won't defend television except to say that Theodore Sturgeon, and I'm cleaning up this quote, once said that 90% of everything is crap. And I really think that's the key, that I would rather be a television critic in 2003 than a movie critic, because the top 10% of what's available on television to write about is better than the top 10% of movies, because after a few really good movies each year, that falls off really dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, the most disappointing television season that I've seen in quite a few years in terms of the new stuff, but a lot of the old shows that I like are still around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think television, you know, as long as television can crank out something like A Singing Detective that just, I feel, is the best thing ever made anywhere,
mm-hmm.
one of them, then I will say it's worth putting up with. Don't throw the TV set out the window quite yet. Just be as discerning as you clearly are.
But one of your views as a critic, isn't it, is not that it's as good or bad, but that it's a huge cultural force and you're going to comment on it.
Yes.
Okay.
I need to eat.
Yes, you need to eat. So we talked about television news a little bit, and I did want to ask another question there. It seems to me that when I watch television news now, and I grew up, by the way, watching Walter Cronkite on CBS long ago. I can actually name all of the
CBS. As did I.
I could name all the correspondents to this day, I think.
Boy, that must be fun at parties.
Yeah, well, I don't get invited back. But but it seems to me that the news really is just a form of entertainment now. Am I detecting that correctly on the Fox News and CNN?
I mean, they still try to do some real things, but there were things that would have gotten us very upset 10 years ago. The TV critics even have given up the fight on.
What kind of things are those?
Things like, if you think about local news, where there's a tie-in to a movie that's opening that day or to a TV show that was on that night.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we're on the set of Friends or we're doing this. That stuff that when they began doing it 15 years ago or so, we used to accuse them of selling out to the entertainment divisions and not taking themselves seriously. And now no one cares about that. You know, I mean, people laugh at us when we get upset about it.
So it's a lost battle right now.
That's a lost battle. And in terms of look what happened earlier this season, all of a sudden Michael Jackson was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that should be.
To be replaced by Jennifer Lopez and,
yes,
Ben Affleck. So, well, maybe then we should move on to comedy.
I don't know that it's that much of a change.
Right. I think, other than breaking news, that really the single best use of the medium for just entertainment is the television sitcom, the half-hour sitcom. I think it fits the size of television and the way which I like to watch it usually. And when you wrote Teleliteracy in 1996, Seinfeld was just a little over halfway through its run. And I wondered, have you reassessed that series, and how did it change television comedy?
Well, I was actually, it was in the books. I mean,
it was only halfway through its effect, maybe.
Right, but I mean, it had made its impact clear as far as I was concerned. And it's funny, I teach courses in TV history, and you look at Seinfeld, and everybody thinks of it as this incredibly groundbreaking situation comedy, when really, if you go all the way back to the beginning and the Jack Benny program...
I was going to mention that, yeah.
It's the exact same show.
I listened to some Jack Benny television, or rather radio shows,
yes,
and they had much of the same irony and much of the same mocking of the sitcom, and it was very much an echo.
Very much, and even the same sort of things as recurring characters who wouldn't even show up in each episode, but you were delighted when they did show, and entire episodes that could be built around something like Jack Benny going out to shop for Christmas gifts. So it was, you know, Seinfeld is very much in the tradition, but it's one thing to say that this is using the same form, and it's another to say it's written and performed so brilliantly that it's funny and it sort of attracts everybody.
Yeah, I actually find them worthy of repeat viewing. I've come to like George, actually, as a character, or appreciate that comedic portrayal, which I don't think I did at first. I don't know if you had a similar reaction. Perhaps you liked
all of them. I actually liked all four of them.
From the beginning. Well, I'm thinking of some other ways maybe Seinfeld has changed. Do we have quicker scenes in sitcoms now?
In some, and that's just a function, again, of people being very nervous. If you look at Curb Your Enthusiasm on cable, which Larry David, by the way, was the co-creator of Seinfeld, so here he's done one great show on broadcast TV using those constricted forms, and then another one on cable.
And do you think he knew about the Jack Benny show? Was that
there's no question.
Okay.
I mean, you know, he's just too good not to.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to him about that and about Fawlty Towers and John Cleese, and he says he's aware of all those things, but he wasn't really, you know, he was aware of them only in that he absorbed them as a viewer when he was young.
Sure. Sure.
That he wasn't setting out to do a modern Jack Benny or a modern Fawlty Towers.
Mm-hmm. But David, I interrupted you. You're pointing out that Larry David has done Curb Your Enthusiasm and also was a creator of Seinfeld. And that the quicker scenes came about because of that? Is that?
Yeah, well, I mean, but he's, you know, the quicker scenes in Seinfeld, I mean, there's tons of scenes running around, but in a lot of standard sitcoms, you still have the same three-room, three-set, four-camera move around. It depends on what they're doing as a show.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly all of television, not just sitcoms, but the pace is so much different now than it was even 20 years ago.
In the sense that people are really watching for a few minutes at a time and flipping a channel or walking out of the room, is that what's going on?
Even if they're not, the networks are afraid they will.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying that the pace of, like, say, a sketch on Saturday Night Live when Saturday Night Live began might have gone 8-9 minutes. You won't see that anymore.
Mm-hmm. This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with David Bianculli, television critic for the New York Daily News and NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and we're talking about television. Please call at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Now, from Seinfeld, there was a number of spinoffs by Michael Richards, by Jason Alexander, by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I believe. Why did all those fail?
Well, technically, they weren't spinoffs because, you know, they weren't the same characters.
Fair
enough. They were subsequent series starring those actors. Most of those do fail. I mean, first of all, you have to start with most TV series fail.
Mm-hmm.
8 out of 10 don't make it back, or 7 out of 10 in a good year, to a second season.
Mm-hmm.
And so any new show is going to fail, even if it's got a star from a successful program, or is more bound to fail. But then you have, if they're really identified with a character, to accept them as a different character is asking a lot of the audience and a lot of writers.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a handful of performers that have pulled it off a couple of times. You think of Carol O'Connor shifting from Archie Bunker to In the Heat of the Night. He had to go to drama and play Rod Steiger's character in order to do it. But most times it doesn't work.
You know, I think one of the few exceptions that really proves the rule you're talking about, and it's amazing, was Lou Grant moving from a sitcom comedy character to the same character in a serious
drama.
And I think
it was the same character, which helped, but that was a very bold thing to do.
It's almost unheard of, really, isn't it? Do you have hopes for Joey's new show from Friends?
I don't know that that's that strong a risk. I mean, you look at how Cheers, which was this incredibly durable, long sitcom on Thursday night on NBC, then took one supporting character out and threw him in an entirely different environment on a completely different coast. And that worked. You know, that's essentially what they're doing. And if they say that they're not doing that intentionally, they're lying. They're taking the Frasier model, which is the biggest success in a generation. And they're trying to do that with Friends.
David, we have a couple callers. Line 4 from Paris, Illinois. Please go ahead.
Yes. The reason I was calling was that I was intrigued on your comments on television. But last week, I'm an emergency room doctor. I was taking an advanced trauma course. And we were all talking about how we all watch Cops.
Cops.
And learn new things, lingo, stuff going on that we never knew before. So I was interested in his comments about reality shows like that, ER and some other things that seem to do really well, and even professional people latch into a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. I mean, Cops is one of the oldest, well, it is the oldest reality show that's on television right now. And it was one of the granddaddies of TV reality, and the idea is you just follow these cops around, and whatever happens, you film, and that's exciting enough. The fact that it's still there and very quietly still winning its time slot and being, I think, the most popular program on Saturday night says something about its appeal. I didn't know that it was appealing to professionals, you know, like EMTs and people like that, but now that I think about it, it doesn't surprise me.
I've never thought about that angle.
And it would probably gratify the filmmakers very much, you know,
sure,
to see that they're watching that.
David, we have another caller, a caller from Eureka, Illinois on line one.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. This is a little different line, but could you comment on the Food Channel? I'm wondering, is it holding its own or
oh,
losing?
Yes, it's doing very well.
So David, what is the most popular channel or rather show on the Food Channel? Do you know?
Right now, I wouldn't know. I can tell you, you know, what the most popular are with me, but
what
I actually haven't tracked those ratings.
What do you like on the Food Channel?
Well, it's I'm an Iron Chef guy, and always have been. But there's a lot of different things up there. The Bobby Flay, I think, is his barbecue thing is also a Food Network stuff. I have to confess that I don't watch it, you know, religiously the way I watch some other things and bounce back and forth. But it is very healthy and has spawned a lot of competitors.
David, how many TVs do you own?
Well, in my little basement right here where all the phones are ringing, I have 13.
On? Are they all on? Or?
No, actually, I have only one on right now. But in times of crisis, they're all on.
We also have a caller from West Champaign on line two. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi. In sort of response to the emergency room doc that just called, I'm a family practitioner. And I think the first reality and most excellent medical program that I ever saw in my life was St. Elsewhere.
Oh, good for you.
And the very first program that endeared itself to me, I graduated med school in 78, and the thing we used long before PDAs were available were clutches of 3x5 index cards, which we scribbled patient data on and stuffed in our bulging pockets. And the opening scene to the first episode of Saints Elsewhere showed a bevy of medical students on rounds going through their piles of index cards, following on rounds down the hall.
Oh, that's funny.
And it every little detail on that program was so well and validly done that medical students, docs, residents, interns, everybody tuned in on that one. And that was long before people knew what, quotes, reality TV was about.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I remember when that show did premiere, I actually invited a bunch of doctors and nurses that I knew over to my house to watch a preview tape early.
Oh.
And they did all have that same sort of reaction. It's like, oh, my God. And they were throwing out names of people in the hospital that it reminded them of, and this was the cranky old guy that was headed of the department.
They got the details right.
Yep.
David, do you think it was the authenticity that made that show interesting? Did that help?
It was such a well-written, well-performed show. You know, it was never a huge hit, but the people who liked St. Elsewhere are people who loved it from the beginning to the end, and they're the people I would most like to be stuck in elevators with.
David, we're getting closer to the time, but there is one thing I want to do. We're lucky here at a local video store to be able to rent The Singing Detective. And you once said of this series, it's the best work ever written for television, and adding to your quote here, you said, no exceptions, no qualifiers. So tell our listeners about it. What made this great television?
I wrote that in 96. Still true. You know, I've been looking for the thing, I've been looking for something to trump Singing Detective, and nothing has. It is a very involving 7.5-hour program that is the sort of television that you can't do other things while you're watching. You have to watch it. You can't iron. You can't, you know, deal with your kids. You can't run back and forth. And it does not really reveal itself until about 2 hours in, where it throws threads from 7 different storylines at you, and they don't all come together in this knot and until about the second hour. But if you stay there for that 2 hours, I swear you'll be treated to something that you'll never forget, and maybe, as I feel, you know, seeing one of the best things you've ever seen in terms of the visual arts. It's just to describe it might turn more people away from it than towards it, but it's a great work.
David, we'll leave it at that, and thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Okay, thanks very much for the hour.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with David Bianculli, television critic for the New York Daily News and Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and the author of a fascinating book called A Dictionary of Teleliteracy. The technical director for this segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson. And let's now turn to Todd Gleason, who has the latest Board of Trade settlement prices.